Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 1st of September 2018, Episode 2, as I read on forward. Martian probe set to hunt for Mars quakes. Mika McKinnon, Insights Mission Control, California. The newest robotic residence of Mars has begun its 2-year mission to investigate the deep unknown. Unlike every other spacecraft that have visited Mars, NASA's InSight probe won't explore the surface. I suppose the early pioneer, Viking ones, just looked at the surface. Instead, it is set to reveal the secrets within the red planet and make the first ever measurements of Mars quakes. Quote, Mars has so many missions that have been able to explore the exterior by orbiting or by roving around the surface, says Elizabeth Barrett, science system engineer with mission InSight, so this is the name of the probe now, is going to be the first mission that will look further into the interior. The spacecraft touched down on the 26th of November in a region called Elysium Plantia. Elysium, I'm trying to work out what that means, so it's sort of school or something like that. Following a 6-month journey from Earth and 6.5 minutes of Terra, the descent involved burning heat shields and supersonic parachute. Well, deploying a parachute at supersonic speeds, but it's hard to say what the speed of sound is with such a small atmosphere. The landing site was chosen in the hope that it would be a big, flat plain of sand. It does look like it. Sand technically refers to the size of granule. So sand granule, you can sort of pick up and see with human eye. I suppose I mean that. The team wanted to land somewhere with as few of the rocks as possible. Sorry about this slight wind blowing pages around. Because InSight, the rover, will use its robotic arm to gently pluck instruments from the spacecraft and nestle them into the surface. InSight is equipped with an array of geophysics tools. The seismometer to detect the movements as small as the diameter of an atom. Vibrations, I suppose. A heat flow probe that will burrow like a mole into the depths. A radio experiment that will unmask even the tiniest slosh within the molten Martian core. Yeah, because there's really no magnetic field left, is there? Each is geared to explore the planet's structure. Some help determine the thickness and composition of the crust, mantle and core, while others tell us how much heat the planet has now, according to scientists, allowing scientists to untangle the history of eruptions. By studying the inside of Mars, we will have a better understanding of how rocky planets forms. The differences and similarity in how Earth and Mars came to exist. Though Mars is just a tiny fraction of the size of Earth. The InSight may even be able to measure the pitter-patter of meteorites that strike the surface of Mars by picking up seismic waves of impacting space rocks. I think that's what they found on the moon. This isn't the first seismometer to go to Mars. Both the Viking missions, the two Vikings in the 1970s, carried seismometers, although only one of them was functional after landing. But the Viking seismometer was mounted on the spacecraft's deck, which caused unforeseen problems. Unfortunately, the deck of the spacecraft is cushioned by springs that are dampening the landing, and it's rocked by the wind as it blows past. The seismometer was very good at measuring the wind rather than actually seismicity of Mars. Now, the wind, it would be pretty high velocity wind, but it's such a thin atmosphere there. One of the scientists on InSight's mission, that gets me because there's no scientists on the mission. There's scientists looking at the mission, the insights on its emission, there's emission control, saw it as the duty, his duty to ensure the seismometer could be placed correctly on the ground, she says. Well, hopefully there's one scientist, rather than no scientist. The successful landing this week was a cause of major celebration, as always. That's what, the only thing we want to watch now. It's landed well. Oh, let's have some excitement in the control room. A mission control in NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, the room was full of delighted relief. A celebratory feeling with a hint of shock that it all happened so quickly. With each new report of incoming data and its beeps, cheers and clapping spreads again. It was a perfect landing to start InSight's adventure on Mars. I love it. Isn't it beautiful? Barrett says this is just the beginning. In the next few months, the lander will begin to deploy the instruments and start gathering data in earnest. She is excited for the big mission milestones, like hammering the heat flow probe into the ground and recording the first Mars quake on the seismometer. Surely you would want to, you know, to calibrate it by putting the seismometer down and then thumping the thing into the ground, listening. InSight also broke new scientific ground about the use of a pair of CubeSats, lunchbox size, but that's a beautiful way of describing it, probes collectively known as Mars Cube 1. I think the carton of milk size, it's 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres, it's like a carton of milk. This means that for the first to accompany the spacecraft and relay signals back to Earth. This means that for the first time we received a real-time report on the Mars landing, limited only by the speed of light. My problem is that these satellites would continue, they're on their trajectory, the main pod would separate and decelerate, so let's see. The small probes lacked fuel or engines, so were unable to enter the orbit and have already hurtled past Mars. But their successful deployment in future space missions could be similarly accompanied. InSight will now rely on existing Mars satellites, like NASA's Mars Odyssey orbiter, to send back to Earth. Yeah, that is what you really need. You want a long-term transmitter on the outside. So that's the end of that article. This one's by Claire Wilson's. Parkinson's are linked to brain autopilot. People with Parkinson's disease are less likely to make mistakes that happen when we are, quote, on autopilot. The surprising finding helps support the idea about the root causes of the condition that might lead to tests for early signs of illness. So one would expect that it's not a better autopilot, there's just no autopilot there. Let's see what it says. Parkinson is a progressive disease with core symptoms such as slowness, movement difficulties and tremors. We know that it involves the death of brain cells, especially those that make dopamine, which is involved in sending nerve signals. In 2010, Peter Redgrave of the University of Sheffield, UK, and his colleagues went a step further and came up with the idea that many of the core symptoms are caused by loss of automatic movements. Whenever we first carry out a movement, it requires conscious effort. After many repetitions, we do it unthinkingly. Many everyday actions for walking or grasping objects are at least partly automatic. Redgrave's idea is bolstered by more recent work showing that some of the first brain cells to die in Parkinson's disease are those that give automatic control. Well, that would be interesting. They're the first ones, so you could pick it up really easy that way. According to Redgrave, because it's the first one, you'd be able to check automatic control. This will explain why people with the condition start walking or shuffling in a shuffling way, because they're having to think about every step. His colleagues, Tom Stafford, also at Sheffield, came up with a way to test this. Redgrave's premise means that people with Parkinson's are less able to function in autopilot, so should be less prone to errors that arise in the brain from this brain mode. We call this kind of errors action slips. For example, when we dive a certain way to work every weekday, and then wrongly take the route on a Saturday trip to the gym. Mistakes like those can easily be measured. But action slips also happen when we type. People often type thing instead of think, because the ing is a common group of letters in English, for instance. Oh dear, this would be a very complicated one to pick out. So the team designed a typing test that can distinguish between these kinds of keyboard slips and those caused by clumsiness. At its core is software that knows the most common letter combination. Oh God, surely, you just look for certain types of test skips. The researchers got 61 people, which is a good odd number of people, about half whom had Parkinson's, to type sentences with the software analyzer. Surely you could give us a percentage, mate. Is it about half, 30 or 25? Those with the conditions made more clumsy mistakes but fewer action slips than the volunteers, than other volunteers. David Dexter of Parkinson's UK says this is not only sheds light on the condition's causes, but might be the basis of a new test for those with the earliest stage of the illness. Well, you could do that by internet, couldn't you? At the moment, people tend to be diagnosed only once they have a physical symptoms, but sooner treatment starts, the better. There are quite a lot of drugs in development, said Dexter. We need to be ready to use them by being able to spot people who have early Parkinson's. However, the study involved people who had already been diagnosed with the condition, so further work needs to see that the typing test can identify the people for this one. Well, it's hard to say. There's a lot of ethics in this. Do you want to do a typing test, or do you want to do things like eye tracking things with your eye, or hitting a ball, or a computer game? You know, surely you could do something with a computer game. UK homes, this is, you know, like the Pac-Man or something like that. UK homes must switch to green heating systems. Oh no. This is one thing that really confuses me. A heat pump cannot break the laws of thermodynamics. This really confuses me. Who wrote this? Michael Laplage. 10 million homes in the UK must consider overhauling their heating systems by 2035 to help tackle the global warming. Well, as long as the people are not involved, it's just the home. I suppose home, no. I don't know. I don't like that. The occupiers of 10 million homes, or the residents, they will need to install, the homes, I suppose, hybrid heating systems consisting of an electrical heat pump that works alongside the gas boiler. And that is the finding of a report from the UK's Committee on Climate Change, the expert body advising governments on how to meet climate targets. Insulation seems the way to go, mate. We are talking about large-scale rollout and also dropping people's expectations, says David Joff of the committee, who is currently installing such a setup in his own home. Oh dear. Installing these hybrid systems in a house should cut the natural gas use by 70% or more. In longer terms, the gas supply system should be switched to carry hydrogen fuel to boilers to cut emissions still further. I don't think you can easily do that, mate. By 2050, electrical heat pumps might entirely replace gas. Okay, I just find this appalling. Now, buying green heating systems won't be cheap. While the running costs of hybrid systems should be similar to those of the gas boilers, that front costs high. Geoffrey says his system will cost around £14,000, with grants available to cover £4,000 of it. That's a fair amount of money, mate. If you come out to Australia, you'll pop a few solar cells on you. Depending on the development of hydrogen-ready appliances and the cost of premium to overhaul gas boilers, the government should consider mandating hydrogen-ready heating appliances by the mid-2020s. The report states it compares such a push that requiring to use more efficient condensing gas boilers in the past. It's clear that the world urgently needs to switch to clean, green ways of heating buildings. Three things, like come out to hot Australia. Three things need to be done to achieve this, says Richard Lowes of the University of Exeter in UK, who is studying energy policy. Quote, reduce demand with energy efficiency delivery, electrify heat with heat pumps, and grow heat networks in dense urban areas. Sweden has reduced heating buildings by 90% this way. I think it's that, where the heat the entire neighbourhood. Of course, in Australia, with the up here with the houses so far apart, there's not much you can do. Okay. News and technology. First, farmers keep wildfare on the menu, the corn barris. It's a familiar tale. When humans started farming, their lifestyles changed radically forever. People stopped foraging and had a narrower, nutritionally poorer diet. But new evidence suggests we may need to rethink the story. So you had the idyllic people sort of roaming around the thing, someone began farming, and what's on the menu? Oats, oats, oats. What's this? It's meat. No, it's oat in the shape of meat, and that type of stuff. Farming arose in many places, but the Fertile Crescent, an area that today includes parts of Egypt, Iraq, and other countries. Was one of the first. I only question that because I remember studying the Fertile Crescents between the Euphrates and the other river there. I thought it was much smaller than across to Egypt. Now, many archaeologists assume that the big shift in what people there ate when they became farmers 12,000 years ago. For thousands of years, they had gathered and eaten a wide range of plants, whereas early farmers mostly grew and ate flax, barley, chickpeas, and einkorn. I've never had an einkorn, eh? This assumption hadn't been rigorously tested, says Michael Wallace of Glynis Jones at the University of Sheffield, UK. That sounds like a cue to test it. Cue, come and test it. So they examined the archaeological evidence from 75 sites across the Fertile Crescent, all between 7,000 and 14,000 years old. So that's at the time it's switching over. Sifting through this for clues to ancient diets, the team found hunter-gatherers who lived in the area before farming may have eaten a narrower diet than we assumed. That could be force them into farming. I don't know what. Is it like the Aboriginals have a pretty broad diet by hunter-gathering? At sites occupied by these pre-farmers, had only 13 plant types, including winter wild oats, sea cabrush, that sounded yum, and plants from the cabbage family. These were presently mentioned. Let's dine out tonight. What's happening? And we haven't built the cities yet. Okay. These were present in high enough amounts to suggest they were definitely collected for food. Alright, they've suggested it. What's more, 5 of these 13 and dozens of other wild plants still appear to have been eaten by farmers 8,000 years ago. So let's work out what they're doing. Okay. A very long time after farming revolution, so something happened between 8 and 7,000 years. This study shows the agricultural communities continue to eat wild plants, says Amila Arantz Ortig at the University of Copenhagen, Denmark. Earlier this year, her team discovered that some of the last hunter-gatherer communities in the Fertile Crescent baked breads, a foodstuff once assumed to be invented by farmers. Or they traded for wheat, you never know. Together, these findings suggest a switch from hunter-gatherers to farmer wasn't as drastic as we thought. This might alter our current explanation for why everyone in the area ultimately became farmers, says Jones. It was thought that a changing environment made wild foods less abundant, forcing hunter-gatherers to begin growing crops to develop it, the first farmers. Yeah, you can imagine that. But now it looks like farmers continued to forage wild plants, suggesting these were still readily available. Instead, wild resources may have been so plentiful that most hunter-gatherers across the region could afford to stop wandering, settle down, and experiment with farming while still enjoying ample access to their pre-agricultural data. I actually rather like that idea. Once the process began, says Joan, there might have been a region-wide co-evolution of plants and people. Several of the plants became crops, and all the people became farmers. I sort of like that comment. Okay, this one is Ivan Yi. Ocean meadow loss is adding to climate change. So if you don't know it, you can go through these areas where there's these big kelp plants, big kelp meadows there in Jervis Bay in Australia. So this is just a little tidbit of information. So there's these big things, these big areas of Jervis Bay where you can't motor, you're not supposed to motorboat and fish because of these meadow grass areas. And Jervis Bay is part of the Australian Capital Territory. So the Australian Capital Territory is inland, but its port and naval base of the Australian Capital Territory is on the New South Wales coast. Just go figure that for your geography books. Okay, human activity has devastated a quarter of the seabed along the coast of Kenya, resulting in the destruction of key habitats contributing to climate change. These aquatic plants grow along the shoreline in the shallow ocean. They provide a home for marine animals such as turtle, fish, but it wouldn't be crustaceans, but also absorb carbon from the atmosphere through photosynthesis, but also by decaying would be equal. Mark Haxham of the Edinburgh Napier University, UK, and his colleagues have used satellite images of Kenya to look at detail the seagate coverage of Southeast Africa, a region that has previously been poorly studied. Well, I suppose. After comparing the current images of four sites to those from 15 to 30 years ago, the team concluded that Kenya's seagrass meadows are shrinking by 1.6% every year. Well, I don't know how you could conclude that from just two data points. You'd really want, like it could have been okay and then suddenly fell off the cliff, or it could have declined quickly and then stayed there, or I don't know. But four sites you can do it. The decline showed no sign of slowing. So they must have, had a few images. That doesn't get to me. Just compare two points. Huxham says human activities are the main drivers of loss, especially fishing nets, boats, anchors ripping through the meadows. What's more, carbon that would have been locked up in the seagrass at those four sites end up in the atmosphere instead. The researchers estimated the amount of over 2 million tonnes of carbon, equivalent to 7 million tonnes of carbon dioxide. Okay, you're allowed to do that. That's just adding the oxygen, which is 32 to the 12. Oh, let's work this out. A tonne of carbon is atomic weight 12. Oxygen's 18. It's more than what's it? Two to seven. I'll pay that one. Globally, seagrass meadows have been vanishing at the rate of 7% a year since 1990, which is comparable to the loss of coral reefs and rainforests. So they've only got 1.6 per year, and globally, seagrass is absolutely devastating at 7% per year. So, however, the impact could be felt particularly hard in Kenya because the seagrass has strong links with the health of fisheries. Although the rates of loss in Kenya are less than those at some other countries, given the high reliance of coastal people on the fisheries, we think it's a serious situation, says Haxham. Thank you for that piece of information. Sorry for being a bit... I'm not a sceptic, I'm sort of skeptical of my own scientific stuff, so there you go. Okay. By Alice Klein, hit glandular fever virus to treat MS. So you treat the glandular fever virus, which is Epstein-Barr, if I remember, to treat multiple sclerosis. So that's an interesting thing. Okay, this article. Training the immune system to fight Epstein-Barr virus, which is the cause of glandular fever, led to improvements in multiple sclerosis, MS symptoms, a small clinical trial has concluded. So, it's what percentage and what's the p-value. The Epstein-Barr virus has been suspected as a possible cause for MS because people who have glandular fever, also known as infectious mononucleosis or mono are more likely to develop neurogenetic conditions. So MS is your own immune system coping. Multiple studies have now confirmed that almost every person with MS carries the virus and that non-carriers almost never develop the conditions. Well, that's a major point. After most glandular fever episodes, the virus lies dormant in immune cells called B cells without causing any further problems, says Rakib Khanna of the QIMR Berghofer Medical Research Institute in Australia. Wow. I wonder where that is. Queensland Immunological, I don't know what MN stands for, but Berghofer must be some, it's an institute, I don't know how big it is. But evidence suggests that the problems with some people's immune systems allow the virus-infected B cells to invade their brain and spine. Those people's brains. The cells may then go rogue, attacking the prospective coating around the nerve as the demyelination, leading to the hallmark damage in MS. So I think there's five types of brain cells just to go. You've got your neuron, you've got your astrocytes, you've got, I don't know, there's other ones, there's ones which support, there's ones which insulate, there's ones which support and transport nutrient by creating a blood-brain barrier so that the neurons actually don't ever come into contact with blood. How about that? There's hair cells, and there's also little mobile cells. So in your brain, believe it or not, there are these mobile cells which go around mopping things up. It's an amazing thing. So like only 10% of your brain is actually neurons. The other 90% do other things. Okay. Khan and his colleagues wondered if they could help people with MS by encouraging their immune systems to control the Epstein-Barr virus. The hope was that in doing so, they'd improve the symptoms, which commonly include problems with vision and muscle control. Mm-hmm. Well, gee, that's a weird one. In 2013, the researchers tested the idea with a man with MS, one man. They extracted a subset of his immune cells called T cells, sharp P cells, B cells, and by exposing them to Epstein-Barr antigens, trained them to attack the virus. Then, re-injected the cells into his body, which I suppose he can do. Afterwards, the man reported feeling less tired, having fewer painful, just one man, balance, and being more productive at work. Hannah's team recently tested the same approach in 10 people with progressive MS in a form of a disease, which the symptoms are constant and steadily get worse. Unlike the relapsing MS, which is a symptom-free period, there are few treatments available for the progressive type. So there's two types. There's one which is episodic and another one which is progressive. Deary me. I wish we knew that at the start of the article. Seven of the people reported improvements, including increased energy and ability to do everyday activities, as well as better concentration and mental clarity. I just really wish they had done a control. In four people, levels of MS-associated protein called immunoglobulin G also went down. I suppose that's just immune rubbish. None of the people in the study reported serious side effects. Okay. The findings strengthened the idea that the Epstein-Barr virus plays a role in MS, says Hamish Campbell at the MS Research Australia. However, it remains a mystery why only a small percentage of virus carriers go on to develop the condition, he says. There may be genetic reasons why some people's immune systems are better at managing the virus than others, he says. The clinical results are exciting so far, says Cam, but the treatment still needs to be compared against a placebo and larger groups of people. His team is currently planning a bigger trial in Australia and the US that is due to start in the first half of 2019. Okay, that's good that you're actually telling me that. So this is by Michael Marshall. Shallow seabed can act as a tsunami trap. So a shallow seabed traps a tsunami, so the tsunami is trapped there. So it goes in there and resonates for a while. I suppose that's what it means. Tsunamis can keep pummeling. Okay. Tsunamis can keep pummeling the same patch of coast for days at a time, if conditions are right. The finding means the initial big wave may not be the only source of danger, and authorities might need to rethink tsunamis' evacuation responses. What? Okay. On the 8th of September 2017, a deadly magnitude 8.2 earthquake struck off the south coast of Mexico. The quakes caused a tsunami in the Pacific Ocean. Okay, it must be the Pacific side quake. This reached a maximum height of 3 meters when it hit land, which is modest by tsunami standards. However, it was unusually long-lived, lashing of the coast for 3 days after the initial wave. Long-lasting tsunamis have been seen before. The wave in 2011, Tohoku tsunami, that devastated parts of Japan, which detected across the Pacific for 5 days. I think that's not a shallow seabed. The Pacific is not a shallow seabed. But that tsunami caused a big earthquake, and it was the first wave. It was 30 meters tall. The persistence of small Mexican tsunamis is surprising. I am surprised as well. To work out why it had such staying power, Deco Mega, the University of Oregon, and Angel Ruiz Anglo of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Autonomous University of Mexico? What? Oh, I suppose. Modeled it on a computer. Oh, amazing. It's in computer. That's quite amazing. It must be right then. Key factors seem to be that the tsunami originated not far from, far offshore, and with the Tehuantepec continental shelf. This region of the ocean is very flat, and the shallow seafloor stretches more than 100 kilometers offshore. And tsunamis here become trapped, just like knocks, and just knocks it about for a long time. This is from the Pacific one, isn't it? It reflects off the shore and bounces out to sea. When it hits the large body of deep water, the edge of the continental shelf, it reflects back to coast. Yeah, I could well imagine that. So that would be any, what is it, different Z reactants? I forgot what the term is for it. If the region experienced a big tsunami, it might remain dangerous long after the first struck the coast. Civil authorities should bear this in mind when planning tsunami evacuation responses. This is medium interface. But on the other side, it means that if a tsunami happens within that region, it's worse. But it means that there's two barriers for the tsunami to go across. You've got, so it's like a refractive index. It's not a graded refractive index, it's a step refractive index to get reflection off it. So I'm just trying to think what it's called. The impedance. I should do it. I'm really sad I can't teach this sort of stuff. Hens get Fitbits to help them stay healthy. This is in brief, so there's no authors with it. Chickens are getting backpacks to help them keep in good shape. They wear tiny electronic packs that analyse the bird's behaviour, which could reveal if something's up. So these chickens are obviously not edible chickens, because these chickens just grow, get eaten. So what's going on? The device contains accelerometers that record the movement. An algorithm uses data from sensors to identify when and how long the chickens perform the various activities, such as preening, which gives a vital clues about health. This should help show whether the birds are being disturbed by parasites, such as the northern fowl mite, which I suppose is not an Australian, which feeds on the chicken's blood. I hope so. Well, it's got to feed on something. It says Amy Muller at the University of California, Riverside, one of the team that developed the wearable tech. The mite mainly affects egg-laying hens, which are kept alive much longer than those bred for meat. At the moment, farmers have to check chickens manually, individually, for signs of the mite. And technology could be made by monitoring the birds far less labour-intensive. Sure, you could just hoover it and have a DNA test for it. Something like that. They're killed. I vets that go into these big chicken farms, and they just go in, break a neck. They don't. Once they've picked up their bird, it's the birds, I think, only $1 each or something, they've got a value of a couple of cents each. So it's a pretty gruesome thing to see vets go through chicken farms. The technology could be made make monitoring the birds far less more labour-intensive. To train the system to analyse chicken movements, Mirko and her colleagues filmed hens wearing the backpacks, which they dubbed Fitbits for Chickens. That's very imaginative. I would say cluck bits. Cluck bits. They then labelled the birds' behaviour accordingly, so the systems could associate various activities with movement data. The algorithms can now automatically classify pecking, preening, dust bathing, and with over 85% accuracy. Wow. Brain cells rearrange DNA in Alzheimer's. Brain cells have been reshuffling their DNA. I don't know what that means exactly. This may explain how Alzheimer's disease develops and inspire new treatments for it. Surely you would say that this finding, this explanation, will inspire or something like that. Most drugs that combat this type of dementia are designed to clear the build-up of clumps of beta-amyloid protein from the brain. But drugs trials have disappointed. While studying the gene that makes the beta-amyloid called AAPP, Gerald Cunard of Sanford Burren Parish Medical Discovery Institute in California, and his colleagues found that it seemed to be able to reshuffle its DNA, enabling it to take thousands of forms. While studying the gene, can reshuffle its DNA? There are more than 10 times more variants of AAP in the brains of people with Alzheimer's than those without it. These forms can produce various toxic proteins in addition to beta amyloid. It's beyond what the heck's going on there. This finding may explain, reshuffling DNA. God, this is bizarre, right? The finding may explain why Alzheimer's drugs that specifically target beta amyloid have been little success. They may be missing thousands of other toxic products that are a bit different or maybe very different. The team's research suggests that reshuffling is linked to the activity of enzymes called reverse transcriptase, and I've really got to understand that. Existing HIV drugs that block these enzymes may also work on Alzheimer's, says Chan. So I want to work out what reverse transcriptase is. I'll have to read that up. Shine a light on skin to test for diabetes. The way your skin reflects light can reveal your risk of getting diabetes and heart disease. Glucose in the blood can stick to proteins in the skin, forming glycated proteins known as AGEs, which stiffen the tissues. This happens with age, but also can indicate risk of diabetes and heart disease. AGE levels can be measured in the skin because of the way it reflects fluorescence light. Bruce Wolfenbüttel at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands and his colleagues tried AGE testing on 70,000 people. Now, that's what I call a decent study, not 61 of your mates who were free of diabetes and heart disease. 4 years later, with high AGE readings at the start, were more likely to have developed disease and heart disease. That's actually quite good. This test could be used for widespread screening, but trials would have to show it does more good than harm, for example, misdiagnosing healthy people. How sugar can be good. Here's an interesting thing. Fathers can pass on mitochondria 2, it says. This mitochondria 2. That is amazing. So mitochondria is the energy, plasmids, it's rings of DNA in the slave bacteria, which is usually only in the female gene line of eukaryotic cells. So cells with the nucleus have this separate community of DNA. Let's read what it says. The energy making structures in our cells are usually inherited just from our mother. But US doctors have now found more than a dozen people in three families, that's four people, a family, who inherited these mitochondria from both parents. Okay. They seem to be very rare exceptions, probably because the families harbour mutations that disrupt the mechanisms that normally prevent the father's mitochondria being passed on. Whoa, how does that happen? The entire thing with sperm, the sperm is so small, but its DNA package is compressed. How you could just get a piece of... That's making my head hurt. In 2002, a man was found with mitochondria from his father and his mother. But with no other cases since, it's been dubbed as the Dad Advanti. A team at Cincinnati's Children's Hospital Medical Center now say they've identified 70 people with parental inheritance. Well, 17 is more than a dozen, isn't it? But I find that... I'm not upset, I'm not railing against it, it's just a really odd finding. Oh, sickly ants keep their distance. I sort of understand this from a human thing. You're sickly and you just, because you're sick, you just realise that you're cut out of things. Okay, wish your coughing colleagues would stay away from the office. Unlike some humans, ants seem to understand the importance of avoiding others when affected. When foraging ants are exposed to fungal pathogens, they may reduce their contacts with the nest. Natalie Strometht at the University of Lucerne, Switzerland, and her colleagues have studied the common black ants using a tracking system. What is it? Workers in the colonies are split into nurses, which work in the nest caring for the brood, and foragers that collect the food outside. I wonder what the tracking system is. That's a picture of it. You can actually look at the structure of them. Foragers are most likely to pick up infections, but they interact less with other ants and come into contact with those inside the nest. Infrequently, Strometht's team exposed some of the foragers to the spores of Metrahyzium bunnerum. Okay. It's Brunnerum fungus. The spores attach to the ant, and after a day or two, get into the insect and kill it. Okay, I hope you don't care about the ants. Within an exposure, before becoming sick, foragers exposed to the spore change behaviour, spending more time outside the nest and cutting contact with other workers. Foragers weren't exposed to the pathogens, also took steps to isolate themselves. And nurse ants moved eggs, larvae and pupa deeper into the nest. Okay. It's interesting that the ants do that anyway. Revive a dying phone battery with a kiss of life. Oh dear. Don't hate it when your phone battery runs out. In the future, you might be able to give your mouth-to-mouth thanks to a technique that harvests electricity from moisture in air. Water droplets might seem an unlikely source of energy, but they hold a form of static electricity called hygroelectricity. Now, I really want to know what that is. Which is thought to be the source of charge that causes lightning. This charge can be... Well, I'll have to understand what hygroelectricity, but I won't be able to remember. Oh, no. This charge can be transferred from droplets to other tiny particles, such as dust. This has previously been shown that this energy can be harvested by structures made from graphene, a two-dimensional form of carbon. The tiny holes in these structures absorb water molecules when they... they become ionized, generating electric current. However, the structures used for this were bulky, rigid, making them impractical for small-scale electronics. To fix this, Hu Cheng, the University of Qingang University in Beijing Institute of Technology in China, have made them out of thin films of graphene oxide. I don't know how you can have graphene oxide. A meaningful graphene oxide. They can be rolled, stretched, and folded into structures including tubes, pyramids, and balls. Yeah, my only problem is that a pyramid and a ball aren't graphene-like. To make flexible hard get generator, the team used a laser to etch patterns on graphene oxide to set the surface on the surface of flexible films, which were spraying a mist of water droplets onto the surface of the generator, or even breathing it through one rolled in a tube, produces voltages up to 1.5 volts, which is comparable to household batteries. Yeah, there's a major, major difference between getting a voltage and getting a power source. I just find that really hard to understand. Elvetine beasts walk with dinos. Okay, so this would be obviously not a dinosaur, it would be like one of those reptiles. Dinosaurs weren't the only giants of the early Triassic, which is after the Permian era. Fossils of a bizarre elephant-sized reptile, more closely related to mammals, have been found. Which was 5 metres long, 3 metres tall, okay, and weighed 9 tonnes. Okay, given that a ton is a square meter of water, it sort of makes sense. It looked like a bent-legged hippo with a beak and two tusks, according to fossil analysis by Gregor Nedowitzki at the Uppsala University in Sweden and his team. During the Permian period, between 300 and 250 million years ago, Supermian rocks with these dinosaurs, the largest herbivores were mammal-like reptiles called synapsids. So I've got to really remember hydroelectricity and synapsids. Some were up to 3 meters long, weighing 2 tons. Okay. But their reign was ended by the extinction known as the Great Dying after the dinosaurs dominated. At the end of the Permian. A few synapsids survived to the Triassic, but most were less than half a metre long, as it was thought the dinosaurs were the only animals to evolve into giants during the Triassic. But about 208 million years ago, at least one synapsid evolved into a newfound giant. So that's after the Great Dying, which happened at 250 million years ago. So at 42 million years of evolution. It has been named the Lisowice Bogen after the village of Lisowice in Poland, near which it was found. I don't know if that's actually a sense. This was Leditz. It was a village which was wiped out. Oh no, it was a village in Czechoslovakia. It was wiped out when they assassinated Reinhard Heydrich in World War II. So I've just got to get this into my head at the time. So that's interesting. Rolling Stones got Moon in the Groove. Huge grooves on Phobos, the biggest moon of Mars, may have been caused by boulders rolling across it after the asteroid impact. Other planets and moons have similar scratches, says Kenneth Rams of the Brown's University in Rhode Island, but Phobos is covered with them in marks, up to 30 kilometres long and 200 metres wide. I wonder how big Phobos is. Ramsey and his colleagues simulated the Phobos Mars system to examine whether these grooves could have come from rolling stones. The pair says it would have been etched from the Stickney crater formed when the rock was about 1 kilometre across, smashed into Phobos 150 million years ago. Well, they've got a huge... You can see these... It looks like walnut with these big grooves on my... And that would be the only explanation I could think of. How they know something smashed at that particular time is beyond me. It's something smashed into it 150 million years ago. How do they know that? The gravity on Mars would have caused some boulders to swiftly roll all the way around the moon, creating lines that we see on the surface. Well, given that it's in free fall, this is a planet, so in free fall you don't actually feel the gravity of the sun. We don't feel the gravity of the sun because we're in free fall around the sun. So I don't quite understand how that was. There's a tidal effect. I don't know. I really find that really disturbing. What about the lack of boulders on the surface now? Ramsey thinks debris of the impact got trapped in orbit around Mars and hit Phobos again, smashing up the boulders and hitting the small grooves underneath a layer of dust. Yeah, so this is one thing. If it's it is definitely grooved. You've got something really difficult to say. I think it's aliens myself. If you're really sticking up to how something made it, it looks like, I would say that's the clear presence of aliens myself going forward. Okay, I'll finish this and get on to the next go. Here we've got a groove on Phobos, which has been made in a clearly mechanical way by something which is no longer there. So I would say Phobos was mined by aliens. You've heard it from me, but what else could it be? This idea of boulders rolling around and just popping off into space sounds a bit weird to me. Thanks a lot for listening. Podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.